Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When biologist Margaret D. Lauman's sons were kids and somebody asked what their mom did for a living, the short answer was that she climbed trees for a living. Of course, climbing the trees was often the easy part. Lauman has ascended to forest canopies from Australia to West Africa to Panama, collecting leaf samples, discovering epiphytes, and exploring the relationship between trees and the ecosystem that surrounds them. And more often than you would think possible, she brought her boys along with her, sometimes out of necessity as a single parent, and sometimes for the sheer joy of sharing her passion with natural-born scientists, which all kids can be. Margaret D. Lauman is Director of Environmental Initiatives and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the New College of Florida. Her new book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. And she is just back from 10 days in the Amazon. We're delighted she could be with us. Meg, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's really great to be home again.
I bet. What is it like? What is it that you like about being up in a tree working that you can't really experience anywhere else?
I would have to confess first off that I do have a very healthy respect for heights. It could be dangerous in possible circumstances, but I really am passionate about climbing trees because there is such a wealth of things to discover up there. Over half of the species on land in this planet allegedly live in the treetops. So it's a real detective operation, and I guess that makes science really exciting and fun.
So what is it that you're looking for when you're up there? What kinds of evidence are you collecting?
When I first started climbing trees, I had no idea what was up there, and I suppose that because I was one of the first who knew what was up there, so I set out to find out how long live in tropical rainforest. Sounds kind of like a simple question, but nobody knew the answer. When I got up there, I found millions of insects all around me eating the leaves and eating the fruits and eating me sometimes. So in the end, I focused on what we call in science plant-insect relationships, because there are so many bugs eating so many pieces of the tree, and in turn, the whole food chain is generated from those relationships.
How does that work, by the way, with them eating you? Are you reluctant to use insect repellent because it might sort of damage the balance of things up there, or do you have to do that to survive?
I am reluctant for that reason. Obviously, I wouldn't want to contaminate my study specimens. I'm a little reluctant, too, because some of them are pretty toxic to human beings. I have lots of colleagues that have lost watch bands and even clothing from some of the stronger insect repellent, so I can't help but think, what are they doing to our insides? It's pretty easy to dress accordingly, wear long sleeves. We all know that insects are most active at dawn and dusk, at least the insects that love humans. And so you can really tailor your work pretty well to those kinds of conditions.
So as you're studying these relationships between insects and the leaves, one of the things you do is measure leaves. What specific properties do you look for?
Oh, my gosh. I might be the most boring person you've ever met. People think it's so exciting to climb trees, and of course it is. But to actually get the information that I need and create this global database on leaves, I have to measure their length, their width. I have to assess their toughness, age them, classify them with the light conditions and the height off the ground. So there's a whole lot of data that might be important. If you're a bug in that great big green sea of the rainforest canopy, obviously I'm trying to figure out how they find their way to their dinner plate. So that's kind of a daunting task.
Well, and this delighted my 8-year-old son when I revealed this detail to him. Another thing that you study is something called insect frass.
Right. Oh, dear. That is appealing to kids, isn't it? And frass, of course, is insect poop, which is very funny. My kids had a little section in the book you'll have to read aloud to your son saying, how could my mother have a dinner party for 4 hours talking about insect poop with her colleagues? So it is amazing what scientists focus on. That is, of course, another piece in the detective work, because when insects poop, there's obviously ways to relate that turnover to perhaps what they ate in the first place, believe it or not.
Meg, have you already been able to observe changes over the course of your career in the way the rainforests look that you might attribute to global warming?
Absolutely, and extraordinary changes. I did live and work in Australia for over 10 years, and in actual fact, my work there in the 1980s was really one of those canary in the coal mine types of studies where the death of eucalypt trees and the level of insect outbreaks were really part of the bigger drought that Australia had experienced, a little more extreme and a little ahead of other continents on this planet due to a complex number of factors relating to their weather patterns. But Australia really has been in almost a 100-year drought, so they were showing the signs of climate change almost before we even had it in the news over here in America.
Margaret D. Laumann is my guest. She's Director of Environmental Initiatives and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the New College of Florida. Her book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. So let's talk about how you get to where you need to be to do your work. Sometimes you climb up there, but you've actually been floated sometimes to your work site. Can you talk about the sled?
I have, and that actually is my most favorite thing. Not surprisingly, I loved The Wizard of Oz as a kid. That's just such a great book. Mm-hmm. So perhaps being in the sled and the hot air balloon to study treetops ecology might be my closest effort to become like Dorothy. This apparatus was actually invented by some French colleagues. They have a beautiful hot air balloon or dirigible, and it's associated with an inflatable raft that rests on the treetops. And best of all, it has a cute little gadget called a sled, or in French, a luge, that it can be actually towed through the treetops, almost like being in a boat trawling for plankton or some other such thing. We can trawl the canopies for insects and flowers and vines and things that would be really tough to get for us human beings that have to go against gravity.
How sturdy does it feel when you're up there? Do you have to worry about sort of tipping over and dumping out of there?
Perhaps a teensy bit, but it's much more fun than worrisome. Sometimes the fun over, you know, it's probably scary to go on Disney World rides too, but in this case, we actually are harnessed and tethered with a rope. Not that that would be too comfortable if you fell out of the sled, because you'd be dangling until they could get you back to Earth. And many times our little landing pad is miles away from the trees we're working on. But the bottom line is it feels pretty good. It's really fun. And in some ways, it feels a little bit more solid than even being in a rope climbing up the side of a tree trunk, which has nothing underfoot, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have considered this before I read the book, but one of the greatest risks to you out there is, or up there, I should say, is dehydration.
It is, and in actual fact, one picture of me somewhere on my website that seems to have been reproduced in a lot of different places has me with bright pink cheeks because I actually did have heat prostration from not drinking enough water. And people are surprised about this, but the forest canopy is truly like a desert on the planet, and water goes straight through when it rains, and all of those plants and animals that live in the canopy compete for water in a big way.
You didn't actually live in it, but one of the things you were invited to do was to conduct some research at the Biosphere 2 site, which people might remember as that enormous glass-domed structure in the Arizona desert that was set up a few years ago. Can you talk about what you were doing there?
Sure. And, of course, that biosphere is the product of one of your Texas philanthropists, Ed Bass. I came into the biosphere after the eight people were living there when Columbia University took over and they were developing research programs. I built a canopy access system in the rainforest biome, and I do have to say that despite some of the controversies about trying to get people to live inside a glass dome, that's been a fabulous lesson and public relations exercise for scientists, because it really proved how expensive and tough it is to rebuild ecosystems from scratch. Say, if we as human beings decide to perhaps endanger our native ecosystems on Earth, it would be a very expensive process to restore them. So I went out there, kids in tow, again, because I didn't have too much choice. I couldn't leave them home alone. And the funny thing about that is they, by default, became the first kids to be allowed inside of the biosphere, which was one of those kind of unbeknownst little privileges in their youth.
Yeah, you brought them in without thinking about it, and then somebody said, what?
Right. I don't think the powers that be were too happy, but they did a cute little project counting the invasive species of ants that had, at that point in time, come into the ecosystems, probably on somebody's shoe or in the sleeve of someone's shirt. It's amazing how persistent some of these invasive pests can be.
Well, and that was a really interesting project because, you know, you discovered pests and how quickly they could really populate, and then realized that things like wind are critical to the ecosystem in a way that I mean, people realized before, but you realized it was almost impossible to reproduce certain plant species.
Right. Gosh, you really read the book well. Thank you for that.
It was an interesting book.
Thanks. In this case, that was so neat. The trees in the rainforest biome of the Biosphere 2 were falling down, and they weren't very old, and nobody could quite figure it out because there appeared to be plenty of soil for them to establish. But it did turn out that trees need a certain level of wind, which forces them to develop those support roots. And obviously, when prevailing winds tend to come from one direction, which they tend to do in almost every ecosystem, the tree compensates for it. So in the biosphere, when we were trying to access these tree canopies, and lo and behold, they got to a certain size and the trees were falling over, no one initially knew what to make of this. So it does show you some of the neat things that were gained in terms of ecological information from that glass dome.
Is it disappointing to realize how very fragile life is on this planet?
It is. As a mom, it scares me to death. Mm-hmm. As a scientist, of course, it provides a lot of big challenges and obviously points up the need to create really good solutions pretty quickly.
How did you see your kids evolving as scientists?
Well, I always told my kids they had a scientific career as a youth, and maybe they could become a doctor or a lawyer when they grew up and look after their mom in her old age.
Make some money.
Right. I had no idea that, of course, that kind of passion could perhaps be reproduced in their little minds. So I guess because I always tried to make my research into a game or create a challenge for them to try to do funny things like count the beetles or look for the new spider, maybe it made science a little more fun to them than it might have if they'd stayed in the classroom all the time.
I have to assume it was with some degree of pride that you included several of their childhood science projects in the book. You sort of worked them in. Was there a lot of pressure on them to be the best scientist in their class?
That's a good question that I need to ask them directly, but I think it came pretty easily to them, and I will say that their teachers were always pretty appreciative because they could give really neat talks and bring in a lot of artifacts. So if anything, they probably gave the teachers a small break by coming back from these expeditions and participating in class again. So it worked out for the best.
Well, there are a lot of people now who are raising young children that are struggling with this question about sort of teaching kids how to take risks prudently and then protecting them from every possible risk. I'm wondering, your kids were in some places that people would have considered too dangerous for children, and I'm wondering how you approached that issue.
Well, sometimes I close my eyes and prayed. I'll be very honest. Moms are moms all over the globe. I do admit that because my job had a level of risk, I thought it would be a double standard if I didn't allow them to have certain levels of risk. But, you know, kids are probably more resilient than adults. They probably are much stronger and more adept. So in some ways, as I look back, I think, gosh, maybe that's kind of the kind of heart of childhood, is to have a little bit of risk. And I do worry about kids now because I think that it's, as a parent, perhaps a little more difficult to return to that business of playing outdoors and taking risks. And maybe we tried to make it look fun in the book and include things like the kids' science project so that moms everywhere would allow their kids that little level of getting their feet muddy again.
Margaret D. Lauman is my guest. She's Director of Environmental Initiatives and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the New College of Florida. Her new book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. You can join us right after the break. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Margaret D. Laumann. She's Director of Environmental Initiatives and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the New College of Florida. Her new book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Charles in Denton. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to ask Margaret, you know, in the soil, many tree roots or other plants, there's a mycorrhizal association with the fungus. And I wondered if there's what type of symbiotic relationships there is similar to that in the tree canopies. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Great. That is such a great question and something that I have worked upon as one of the biggest mysteries in the rainforest, this crazy complex thing called mycorrhizal associations is a fungal interaction where some plants actually get an advantage to taking up nutrients if they associate with a particular fungus in their root systems. Eucalypts are one example of that, and actually some rainforest trees have it as well. We've been studying that to find out if it is an advantage that could help plants grow faster in certain kinds of plantation conditions. But the really extraordinary thing about these mycorrhizae is that they are actually found in the canopy as well. But in this case, in orchids and some of the other kinds of epiphytic plants. So to date, they're not really found in the trees or the tree branches, but they are found in some of those plants that grow in the canopy. So I think mycorrhizae is a place in science that you'll hear a lot more about as the world gets larger and the population pressures require a lot more agriculture to occur.
So when you talk about orchids and epiphytic plants, these are plants that take their moisture from the air as opposed to having to be sort of grounded in soil to take up moisture and nutrients.
Mm-hmm. So wild, isn't it? They are called air plants commonly, and it includes ferns, orchids, something called bromeliads, which have kind of a cup in the center with a pool of water, and occasionally even some other crazy things. There are these odd trees that start epiphytically, like the strangler fig, which is totally fun.
How often do you come upon something, Meg, that you have never heard of before?
Oh, a lot. It's amazing. First of all, science is changing daily, as you can now even read in the news with regard to climate change. Things are happening quickly in the fields of rainforest ecology and soil biology in equal fast pace. As the world becomes more global and internet takes over, it's sometimes daunting to try to keep up with all of the knowledge coming out of places like Japan and India and Australia. So I always am learning something new. In fact, I don't even know if I can ever retire because I'll never finish.
One thing that really struck me by about your book was how often you're the only woman in a sea of men. And I don't understand why this branch of science would be dominated by men and not more equal.
Right. I also feel really sad about this and do my best to mentor young women when I give public talks or visit other college campuses, which I do a lot. I think the field of tropical field biology is perhaps regarded as a little rough. It's muddy. Those notions of snakes and insects might be dancing through people's heads because of Hollywood. So I'm guessing that might be why at some point in time women, especially in school age, are perhaps not encouraged to pursue that kind of science. I think in general, the math and sciences lose out. A lot of good women are perhaps encouraged to go in other directions still in our school systems, which is disappointing.
And yet, more than once on your field expedition, there has been a reporter along from Vogue magazine.
Isn't that funny? To this day, we still laugh about that. I think she'll probably never recover. She might have had no idea when she had that assignment. And that was about the rainiest 4 days I'd ever experienced in fieldwork. So there it is. These reporters have to go through lots of conditions, I guess, as well as scientists.
One of your personal dreams was to be able to allow regular people, those who are not scientists professionally, to get up into the treetops where you go without sort of risking life and limb. Can you talk about what it took to finally get that?
Sure. That was, I guess, an offshoot to some of my earlier work with Earthwatch, a neat organization that gets people matched up to help scientists with their field research. And having spent a lot of expeditions with Earthwatch volunteers, I thought, gosh, some of them were too scared to use the ropes or didn't really want to take a climbing lesson. And so on the back of a napkin in a pub in Australia, which is, I guess, the way all things happen in this day and age, the owner of an ecotourist lodge and I sketched the first ever canopy walkway, this notion of what about a trail through the tops of the trees, a pathway of sorts. And so lo and behold, the first one was built in South Queensland, and it was such a big success. It continues to be a success. And since then, I and a couple others started a little company that kind of matches up projects with builders and engineers so that we can go around the world and build these in areas that might use them for conservation.
And it hasn't always been easy even to find engineers because there weren't existing plans, and sort of this is such a new thing.
That's true. Oh, my gosh. In fact, I have to laugh because we built one in Florida, the first public canopy walkway in North America, which took about 2 years to permit in Tallahassee and 2 weeks to build. But when we built one in the Amazon jungle, it took about 2 minutes to permit it from the village chiefs, of course, and about 2 years to build because of the difficulties of getting the hardware down there.
Did you were you a fan of Swiss Family Robinson when you were a kid?
I was. Yeah. I would like to live that way if anybody can direct me to the right location.
Yeah, they had all the comforts of home from their boat. And then
exactly. I know. I think that's maybe it is every kid's dream. I did enjoy that book, too, even though The Wizard of Oz is still my favorite.
One thing you always bring with you, people think of you having this sort of rough and tumble life, but you've always got a supply of Oreos in your pocket.
I do. And I guess over history, they have sort of fared me well. It's really funny, but Oreo chocolate is extraordinarily good, I think, personally, and there isn't such a thing in many parts of the world. So obviously I use it for barter. I use it for energy when I'm really lagging behind. I find oftentimes that I'm in places where the diet really is kind of unforgivable. It's interesting to eat things you've never heard of or you can't even begin to understand what they are, but at some point you sort of wish for a little creature comfort of home. And so taking the stash of Oreos has kind of become my trademark, I guess.
Yeah, and I will say, you're certainly intrepid about going up into the trees, but you are also intrepid about trying to kind of get into the cultures of the people who are around you. You don't just live as an American when you're there.
Right, and you know, that to me has been the real secret of success for conservation work. I think that one of the shortcomings that Americans might have suffered 20 or 30 years ago in going to developing countries with research was to think that we could make the changes. I'm interested in that, but in actual fact, working with the locals is really the secret to getting something done.
One of the things you've done in Cameroon, I guess, was helping people to develop sustainable rainforest-derived products, which sounds like an oxymoron. What can we harvest from the rainforest without permanently damaging what grows there?
Well, we can harvest hundreds of things, believe it or not. And this is really just the tip of the iceberg, I think, for these sustainable products. First of all, if people recognize they can get an economic benefit by not cutting their trees down, it's really valuable. And secondly, we're starting to find out that there are possible medicines in forests. My case study in Cameroon involved harvesting orchids and trying to farm the existing orchid epiphyte plants that grow there and therefore create a lasting market. There are markets, of course, for honey, for Brazil nuts, for hearts of palm. Even iguana is an emerging market from the Central American areas where, believe it or not, iguanas are an invasive pest in South Florida. Can you imagine if we could turn them into a gourmet, instead of sushi, you want iguana?
Iguana McNuggets or something.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, we will start to see these kinds of products emerging, which pay back those people who live there to conserve their forests and maybe try to create markets for things that can grow back.
What do we need to think about when we consider the value or the danger of ecotourism?
I think we probably need to recognize that, you know, there are two ways to go for a lot of these sensitive tropical treasures. And one would be to cut them down for the short-term benefit, and the other would to create ecotourism, which has a small footprint of impact, but obviously allows people to be educated, allows the forest to be conserved, and in the big scheme of things, has far less significant impact than if you clear cut the area and hope that it might grow back.
Mm-hmm. So you don't worry there's a danger that with ecotourism, there's damage that comes along with that?
Not at all. You know, I used to, I must confess, in the 70s, remember those days where all of us baby boomers wanted to put a glass dome over everything we loved. But the practicality of the matter is it's just not fair to the people that live there to assume that they would not touch any pieces of their ecosystem or not allow them to have a certain level of economy that might require things like ecotourism to be developed.
How does it work with a forest canopy walkway? Do they sort of wear out after a few years and do you have to move the structure, or has it turned out to be a pretty sustainable thing that can stay in place for some time?
Because it's new, we're still monitoring those really important questions, but basically, over time, we have found that the one in Australia, for example, is weathered really well. Occasionally, one or two boards have to be replaced. That particular structure was built on telephone poles, which are incredibly durable. But a few others use the trees of the local forest for support, and those have, over time, occasionally required a slight bit of trail movement or shift because perhaps the tree gets termites or something that renders it a little bit less structurally sound.
What are telephone poles made out of? Are they not just big logs?
Well, they are, but remember that when we're working in these other countries, they're made of all sorts of things. And in Australia, they're made of really hard eucalyptus, which probably will outlast everything, including my great-great-grandchildren.
You have coordinated several JASON expeditions. Can you talk about what those projects are?
Sure. And again, a lot of that had some Texas component to it. JASON expedition was a program started by Bob Ballard when he discovered the Titanic. And when he made that discovery, evidently he got thousands of letters from kids asking him if they could go on in the Alvin submarine with him to do some undersea exploration. So when he realized that he couldn't really service this wonderful group of young people that had curiosity about science, he worked with EDS and National Geographic and some others to start this JASON program that uses satellite telecommunication to reach out to museums and kids in different countries and take them via remote communication into some of these wild and crazy places. So after a few years of undersea, Bob contacted me to do some canopy research on the JASON network because it represented another remote and adventurous ecosystem for kids.
So how did they prepare to participate in one of these projects? Because they don't just sort of come into it blind. They've also sort of done some work before they first communicate with you.
Right. The JASON had quite an amazing network of teachers, including the National Science Teachers Association, that worked with me and other scientists to develop curricula programs that the kids could follow. It was aimed at 6th to 8th grade, because I think a lot of people recognize that middle school is a good place to lose young scientists, and this was a critical age for perhaps inspiring them to enjoy science. And so the kids followed the curricula. They had activities. In my case, they built canopy walkways out of popsicle sticks. They made their own leaf toughness monitoring devices in the classroom so they could test out leaves from mom's backyard, and a number of projects that allowed them to engage with the researcher at the time.
And one of the things that is really important about JASON is that there is real science going on. This is not just a matter of you going and sort of putting on a show for these kids. You're also working on valid research.
Absolutely. I was definitely working away, and great for me that I had 24 middle schoolers along with me. That might sound a little bit dark, but there were some
few people would
too.
Say that about anything.
But I think, you know, for my work in the canopy, the more pairs of eyes, the more likely we might find the herbivore, which is the insect eating the leaf. And as you and I both know, kids have much better eyes than adults anyway.
And what kinds of questions do they have for you?
The kids?
Yeah.
Oh, always, how do you go to the bathroom in the canopy? First and foremost, we have to get through the logistics, which is very, very admirable, because I guess everyone is interested in logistics. But they always are interested in how I measure things, how I find things. And then they want to know what they can do back home to help save the rainforest, because I do think children really care about ecosystems.
We'll leave the bathroom question for people to look up on the internet, but you do try to spend the night every time that you possibly can in the canopy.
I do, and for two reasons. Number one, it is fun and adventurous, let's be honest. But number two, because my research takes place in the nighttime hours in many cases. Insects feed preferably at night if they're foliage feeders or leaf eaters or herbivores, whatever words you want to use, because probably they can avoid being eaten by birds. So, you know, if you're something that wants to have your dinner plate up there in the canopy, it would serve you far better to go out munching in the dark than it would in the middle of the day.
So is artificial light a problem?
Not really. Well, actually, I take that back because a lot of times I go far away from artificial light. But artificial light could be a huge problem to ecosystems, and we're only just beginning to scratch the surface about how lights might affect some of these night active animals.
But I'm wondering about you when you're up there. I mean, obviously, you can't see in the dark. Do you bring infrared lighting, or do you have a flashlight that's okay?
Right. Good question. And yes, it does affect us. Number one, your eyes get adjusted, and there's nothing more wonderful than a night with a full moon or a clear sky to allow you to work in the dark. With a headlamp, it can skew things. But one nice thing about what I do is if an insect is feeding on a leaf, the headlamp won't bother it. They are very determined to get their dinner complete. And so if I were counting moths, for example, that fly to lights, I would have a big problem getting accurate data.
Mm-hmm. So you just have to sort of know what you're looking for.
Right. So you really have to think. And that's where methods can be very tricky in science because you can obviously bias or affect your results if you're not careful. Walkways, too, you asked about them, are not a good place to study mammals because we found that some of the canopy animals start using them. They're very smart to do that, but that means that it skews the possibility, perhaps, of doing some accurate population studies about which mammals live in which trees.
They'd probably eat the Oreos, too, if you left
exactly.
them around.
Exactly. We have to be careful. No litter.
Margaret D. Laumann is my guest. She's Director of Environmental Initiatives and Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at the New College of Florida. Her book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Call us and ask a question or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Margaret D. Laumann. Her new book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Meg, you see environmental sustainability, which is living those values and passing them on, as a parenting issue no different from teaching your kids not to cheat or not to lie. Do you sense that that's catching on?
I do think it's catching on, and I suppose that's why I invested so much of my personal time and energy to write a book for the public instead of for my peers. Unless we can raise the consciousness about science as something that drives the world and really and truly controls the quality of life for our children, I think we will be heading in the wrong direction. So I think you had a good analogy that it's an ethic that we need to foster, just like showing kids that they shouldn't cheat or steal. They really need to take care of Mother Nature to ensure their future.
Mm-hmm. And the ability to use science to make decisions is like a life skill.
It is a life skill. And gosh, you know, the importance of getting kids excited about science is really, really critical. I think we've seen an example with climate change about perhaps an issue where the public overlooked everything until it almost feels too late. But I think if 20 years ago we'd all been a little better educated about some of the information, we'd probably be in a very different place right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jimmy in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Hello. Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We always hear of, in fact, study of plants for medicinal purposes. I was curious that is there ongoing any kind of study of insects and their medicinal properties? Or
that is a great question, Jimmy. And, you know, that's kind of the wave of the future. I was actually just in the Amazon with a group of people who are proposing to do that. And as it turns out, when insects eat plants, they actually sometimes take in the chemicals of the plant that have good medicinal properties, and the insect has those properties as well. So I think hopefully in the future we'll be seeing a lot more research on insects and their value to the world of medicine. Unfortunately, to date, there haven't been a lot of pharmaceutical companies getting involved in this kind of work because the payoffs from synthesizing things in the lab seem to have been historically a little better. But people are counting on the fact that in the future this might be another really important area of research.
You talked earlier about the concerns about chemically contaminating the environments you're working in. I'm wondering what sorts of precautions you have to take to avoid accidentally transferring a species of insect or plant or animal from one region of the globe to another.
Probably, and hopefully scientists are a little more kind of in tune to that kind of fear. I think for all of us, we have to rely on having some really good checks and balances when we go through airports, when we transfer our boots or our muddy clothing or whatever it might take. In this case, I think some of the more, the bigger challenges have been bringing things back into human altered environments. The one interesting thing about a place like the tropical rainforest is that when it's in its natural state, there are plenty of predators, and there isn't too much space in that ecosystem to be occupied. But it appears that in areas like South Florida, where we've cleared a lot of the natural organisms out, there's more than adequate opportunity for some of these invaders to come in. So sometimes the problems are much more severe for our return from tropical areas than when we go into these natural areas that have a really healthy ecosystem already established.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you want to speak to Meg Laumann. Her book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. Let's go next to Laura in Arlington. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I am a plant ecologist also, and I wanted to let Meg know that I read her first book, Life in the Treetops, just recently, and I wanted to thank her for presenting the difficulties of doing field work and having small children. I have three small children myself, so I really appreciated her insight on that. And I also wanted to ask her, as a botanist, when you watch small children, they are definitely naturalists and scientists, and they really pick up on animals, but I wonder how you can really encourage small children to pick up on plants and encourage their interest in plants.
Oh, Laura, thanks so much for the compliment about my first book. And I did write that book in hopes people like you would be able to learn from all of my boo-boos and mis-experiences, so I'm glad that it was useful. Yes, your question about making plants exciting is a big challenge, and I did spend quite a few years as the director of a botanical garden competing against fundraisers that involved dolphins or chimpanzees, which, of course, is really, really challenging. I don't think there's anything quite like those wiggly things that move around. So if you can relate plants to the insects that eat them or the monkeys that live in them, that's one helpful thing. Or if you can be extremely creative and talk to kids about how plants actually move as well, or even more cool, how plants create all these amazing defenses because they can't move and weave a story in that sense. So I guess it takes creative storytelling, and maybe as we become moms and develop these kinds of skills, it gets better as we age, but there's no real magic formula except really trying to put those spins on plant stories, because when you think about it, there's a lot of pretty incredible things plants do, but historically I don't think botanists have focused on that quite as much as they might maybe should have.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Brad in Dallas. Hi, Brad.
Hi, I have a question. I've heard a theory that the Ebola virus may actually originate in the canopies of a rainforest, and that that might be an explanation for the relative infrequency of Ebola cases. I just wanted to get your comments.
Right. Brad, thanks. That's a great observation. And, of course, this is not proven, but a lot of people think that some kinds of diseases occur when we actually scrape away or fragment or break down ecosystems that have been operating in a whole sort of arena for a long, long time. The same thing goes the opposite. You know, we've taken some of our temperate diseases down to the tropics, things like measles, where people had never been exposed before. And so this theory is that perhaps Ebola was contained in these tropical rainforests of Africa, and then when people started to clear them and fragment them, some of those germs escaped, in a sense, from the system at large. So again, these haven't been proven in the scientific sense, but the observation and the correlation is extraordinary. And so it is possible that as we kind of invade some of these systems, we might have new spores, new bacteria, new viruses that humans haven't really contacted before, at least humans in the developed countries. And so this type of thing could happen.
You definitely have had your share of illnesses when you have been in the tropics. I'm wondering how you're able to sort of press on when you have a limited amount of time to work and you're just really not well at the time.
Well, I always tell my students, you know, that research is really 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration, maybe a little more perspiration in the tropics. But I do feel passionate about my work. I guess you can tell that from reading my book. And I mainly feel strongly about the importance of understanding the secrets of tropical rainforests because I'm a mom, and I truly want to leave the world a better place for our kids. And I think a lot of the types of science exploration in which I'm involved and many others as well will hopefully create a better quality of life for our kids. So I do feel strongly about that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I'm sorry, I'm a first-time caller, so I'm a little nervous.
Welcome. No problem.
Well, I just wanted to compliment the author. She sounds too young to have small children. but what I really wanted to ask was, in her career as a scientist, has she seen or felt that we are trying to politicize science, and we're not really getting after the facts? We want to get after the facts that prove our point. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thanks for the compliment. Of course, I tell people I'm really 90, and I've just had all those beautiful rainforest elixirs to keep me healthy. but I do think that the politics that have perhaps overwhelmed certain areas of science, especially recently, have perhaps clouded our ability to find and seek good science. So this is a really important issue that you bring up. It's a shame because I don't think too many scientists work for political reasons. Obviously, the paychecks are a lot different from CEOs in large corporations by many, many zeros on the ends of those paychecks. So I think that scientists also are not very well equipped to deal with media. They're not good at developing quick answers or charismatic answers. So we've kind of seen a slippage, perhaps, in terms of how science is communicated and the effectiveness of science communication, almost to the point where it might have drowned in the politics of some issues. So hopefully we're getting back on track. I've never seen a sort of 12-month period where more science has been in the news as recently, and I hope that kind of leads us to a place where science is respected and the words of scientists can have equal footing with politics and economics.
Well, the communication issue is really interesting, and I know it's a personal passion of yours to make sure that you let the world know what you're working on and what's out there. Is this something that ought to be added to the curriculum of students who are in universities training to become scientists? Should they have media relations training?
Absolutely. It is about 20 years overdue, as you can probably figure out now that we've brought this issue to light. It's really tragic that so many fields, law, even salesmen get, you know, courses in public speaking, courses in creating PowerPoints and bullet points. But for the most part, scientists are not subjected to those sorts of coursework activities. And obviously my students are, because I do feel strongly about it. But I do think that we are at a cusp where science really has to get a little bit more savvy about the media and a little bit more friendly to the public in general. But to date, most tenure and promotion actions at universities are based upon publishing for technical audience, and that is certainly very important, but I don't think it's the only function of a scientist, and I hope that some of the provosts and presidents of universities will bring that change to occur very, very soon.
Do you get to spend much time with undergrads?
A lot. I teach undergraduates. Mm-hmm. I teach exclusively undergraduates, so I miss out a little on grad students, although I moonlight serving on graduate students' committees. But I do think it's really important to reach undergrads and try to give them a strong science inspiration.
Do they show up prepared, do you think, or are you really disappointed with the knowledge that they have when they enter the university?
I'm pretty disappointed in a lot of their rudimentary skills in writing and definitely in public speaking. I think we've gone into a phase with high schools perhaps working for testing and not perhaps working for some of those intrinsic skills. But I do think students still have a strong interest in science and definitely in ecology. And so working with that, I hope that I can try to allow them to understand the importance of having those skills that go with the science in order to make a difference.
So are your sons planning science careers?
Oh, my gosh. They are.
Are they? That's exciting.
That's so funny. My first son just graduated from Princeton last year, and he did environmental chemistry. He worked on some of the ice core analyses from Greenland, and that was really exciting. He did things I can't even begin to understand. And he's now a research fellow at Environmental Defense for 2 years, working on environmental policy. And my second son is majoring in applied math, also at Princeton, and he's spending the summer trying to model forests for carbon dioxide and, again, do things that I hardly can understand. But it's a lot of fun when we get at the dinner table.
That's very exciting. And the last thing I want to ask you is what your garden looks like.
My garden. This is very embarrassing. My garden is very bare. I have things that live without any maintenance because I'm away too often. I really gardened absolutely passionately when I lived in Australia. Maybe the challenge over there was the ecosystem was so absolutely extreme that I needed to garden, and also I had a little more time. But here with my travel schedule, I feel that I would be cruel to plants if I tried to plant anything high maintenance. So I have a pond in the backyard, though, and it has all natural edges and lots of lovely birds. So that's been my passion.
Margaret D. Laumann's new book is called It's a Jungle Up There, More Tales from the Treetops. Meg, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.